Accession number 29047, Mr. Len Townend, Reel 5. Now, was there anything else that you recall about your time at 10 Staging?
Well, all I'd like to expand on is the working hours. The working hours was, as I said in the other, but it wasn't continuous. And the main reason it wasn't continuous is because it was a staging post of aircraft flying through from England to India and such, and Vicky Berkey. Well, it was a regular. We used to get one or two aircraft every hour throughout the day. It slowed down at night, but sometimes you'd have a week with nothing, simply because bad weather up the line, particularly on the British end, has stopped the flights. So they were all hanging down at places up the route, trying to get through. So we're just sitting there waiting, nothing to do. It's probably beautiful weather. Well, it was always beautiful weather in Cairo. A mate says to me, I says, lovely weather today. It's a lovely bloody weather every day. But then, when of course the weather got fine, it was up to the neck again because they're all coming at the same time. But certainly there were long periods of boredom, basically because weather, the route wasn't, in those days, it wasn't an all-weather air force.
How are you coping with the climate? We haven't really talked about this. Well, how long did it take you to get acclimatised to it?
Very, very quickly. Again, acclimatisation is a case of being fit, and I was young, I was fit, that was it. And very rapidly you acclimatised to it.
We warned about heat stroke, about sunburn and things.
We went through the peculiar thing where when I first went out to the Middle East, we were all issued with a topi, and of course this all through the British Army records, you all wore topis to save you from heat stroke, which is a load of utter rubbish, and they found out it was a load of utter rubbish. Heat stroke is caused through lack of salt. You're sweating and burning it out. It has nothing to do with the sun on the back of your head. So, halfway through my tour there, they discovered this. Issued us with salt tablet. Well, probably an issue with salt, but anyway. And said, that's it. So, we had a great time. Probably got some pictures. We filled all the topis with rags and tied them up and used them as footballs. And that's about what that happened, quite everything. It was... He used to sweat a lot. Now, that's my problem at the moment. I don't sweat. And it does. It cools you down and you got used to it, and that was it. You kept out the... I mean, when I say we kept out the shade, we lived in tents. They're just ordinary Hessian tents. And we rapidly learned how to deal with the heat. You know, you make sure one side's open and the wind's blowing through as much as it can be. And that's it. Drink lots of water. And that's it. Or the Air Force provided us all with what the chatties, as they were called. They were just earthenware dishes in between all the tents, all the way down. And keep these full with water all the time. It was an extremely good cooling principle. I don't think it's very well known now. These earthenware jars, they were designed to leak, so that they were always wet. And evaporation cooled the liquid inside. Okay, it's not ice cold, but it was cool. It wasn't hot water you were drinking.
And they were called...
Well, we called them chatties. So there's probably some other flippy word for them, but that was the Egyptian word for them. But the people that filled them were the Egyptian workers, and they used to come around with this boiler, and that was their job, to just keep these things filled all the time.
Did you have any health problems out there, in the sense of some people get a bit of drippy tummy or even dysentery?
Oh, yeah. It goes with the... Jippy tummy went with the territory. That was it. Everybody used to get jippy tummy, then just diarrhea, and that was it. It's hard luck. It just
did it last for long?
Usually no, only a couple of days. They didn't put you off work. It's very, very rare. I mean, once I got put in hospital in Cairo with something similar, they never did discover what it was that they got. They put me on, but I must have been fairly bad, because they sent me up to a hospital in Jerusalem, or Tel Aviv somewhere, I can't remember the name of the hospital, just outside Jerusalem. So I was there for about 3 weeks, whatever it was. I don't really know what it was. I don't think they knew. I was just ill. They thought it was malingering. I wasn't, honest.
And what about, how did you get on with the Egyptians? You mentioned the servants. You know, you know. But what about the Egyptians generally?
I've got to be careful here. These days of PC. I thought they were a load of bloody rubbish.
And why? What didn't you like about
they
them?
They were lazy. They tried to rob you at every turn. You couldn't, nowhere could you go without them at that time trying to rob you. I mean, there's all the, you probably heard of the, when you go to Cairo, you had to watch out for them. They wanted actually to clean your shoes. They were absolute ridiculous price they wanted to charge. So there, go away. And the next thing you know, they'd throw muck on your shoes. And things like this, these sort of things. If you were walking on, in those days, it was, we didn't have identity cards as such. We had a pay book, which had our photograph in this little blue pay book. And it was a chargeable offence to lose your pay book because they were saleable. I can only say what the reason, but they said they were saleable to the Germans, so spies, because they could use a pay book as an identification. So we had to have a hole drilled in the top corner. You had a button on the inside of your shirt, and you tied your pay book to your, to the button with a piece of string. And that was there. But always, nobody liked you. You never got to, at our rate, I probably like higher up, nobody ever integrated with the Egyptians at all. They were just there.
So just the servants, that's all?
Yeah, and we didn't really integrate with them. They were just, I won't call them servants, they were just workers. They weren't, at those days, you didn't have servants like that. Probably the officers had batmen, but no, the officers had English batmen, they didn't very
well. I meant the ones who did the cleaning.
The working people. They used to clean clean the toilets out and all that sort of thing. They used to do all those jobs, you know, because there were no flush toilets or anything out in the desert. They used to carry
what were the trains like?
Buckets with a hole in the top. And straightforward, it's just a bucket with a flat top that you sat on and a wooden lid.
Was it surrounded? I mean, was there a bit of privacy?
In most places it was surrounded, but in some they weren't. Some they were open. I mean, there was no women on the camp at all. Well, there was one woman on the camp. That was the Salvation Army lady, a brave lady. And the single, never in places like that. Nowadays, of course, it's totally different. But in those days, Cairo West, there was not a woman on board at all. When an aircraft came through, it was carrying women on. They all used to crowd around to have a look at this. That was it. But there was certainly no women whatsoever at Cairo West.
Now, you'd be there when there was VE Day. Do you remember? Were there any celebrations at all? What did you feel about VE Day?
Not a lot. Just great. Okay, that's it. Then we'll get on with the next one. I know you can't put this in, but just for you, that's the newspaper that's when the war was over.
Was there any, so you didn't have a celebration or anything?
I only had a couple of pints of that sort of thing, nothing exceptional, because for us, nothing changed. It was,
the Chinese war was still on.
Yeah, even when the Japanese war finished, we still had more work than that to do, because we were in the peculiar position whereby we weren't a fighting unit, we were a transport unit. So transport didn't stop. In fact, transport increased. So from our point of view, the actual workload got worse.
Now, anything else about your time there? Because you're there quite a long time. You're there till what, September 45?
Yeah.
Just after the Japanese war. And then you seem to go to Al Marza, to 113 staging
post. Yeah.
Now, what's that?
Well, that's another staging post, but they closed the ones out in the desert because they Al Marza is just on the outskirts of Cairo. I think it's Cairo Airport now, from when I was. It was a big runway airport. Well, of course, Cairo West got a runway. And it was quite close to Cairo. It's in Heliopolis, which, again, is just outside Cairo.
Al Marza's at Heliopolis.
Yeah, well, Al Marza's and Heliopolis running together. It's, you know, it's the same thing.
Now, was this just the same there, then?
It's just the same sort of thing that... it got far more organised there. There was, apart from which the war was over, so the aircraft, we had aircraft actually stationed there. BOAC was stationed there as well at the same time. And when it started, in fact, just before we went, BOAC started their route out to the Far East again, just when the war ended. and they hadn't got any ground crew out there. BOAC hadn't, so they seconded us. The Air Force did it for them, and BOAC generously paid us a little bit for it. I can't remember how much. It was a pittance, but it was a tip sort of thing. We weren't allowed it. I mean, government rules and Air Force rules and regulations weren't allowed to be paid for it. But we serviced the BOAC aircraft for quite a while. And when I went to El Marza from Cairo West, I got in the BOAC school there, because they had a BOAC school, and I was training for an aircraft license.
And now tell me about that.
Well, actually, at Cairo, you see, they set up a school, and the school was manned by British instructors, but they were training Egyptian engineers to operate aircraft. And so when we found this out, towards the end of the war, they had a scheme for, I forget what it's called, but training the airmen to be able to go out, and used to have training schools and things like this.
To go out where? Sorry.
Into Civvy Street, sorry. Training them ready for a demob back to Civvy Street. It was like so often in the forces, when they suddenly find you haven't got a job, they find you something they don't like to get.
So lazy. You were training to be a civilian fitter?
Yeah. The same job, but I was training for the license, because it was a sea license. I was after to start with.
A sea license?
That's what it's called in those days now. I don't know whether it's called the same now. That was a sea license for aircraft servicing. Exactly the same job as I did in the Air Force, of course. But you had to know the civilian regulations, most of it. And I did about 6 months with them. Apart from my job, I used to get released. I was out on the job, because when we got to El Marza, there wasn't so much work going on. And I had quite a good time with them there, and it's a pity actually I didn't take it up, but I didn't. That's another story. But that was at Cairo West. That was at El Marza. Now, while I was at El Marza, I was a little silly young lad as well. I was 21. I had my 21st birthday while I was at El Marza. I've got a picture of myself in the fez. I'm drunk as a with a bomb coat. But anyway, that's beside the point. I remember it's my 21st birthday. That was while I was at El Marza, and it's just stupid things and that. And I wasn't happy still being en route. I was getting fed up with this, just running it, servicing airplanes and punching them in. So I pushed to go into what was called a power plant bay.
What's a power plant bay?
Well,
you can't see it, remember?
No, I realise. I just think, put your own mind, so you can get it there. Go it somewhere here. Well, by this time, you know, I was telling you about you changing engines. By this time, and on Dakotas particularly, the idea came up of, instead of having to change an engine, when you change an engine, you've got to take the engine out and hundreds of bits and pieces and all the rest of it. They formed into what they call a power plant. Now, the power plant was all enclosed in one. All the engine bearers that bolted it to the aircraft, they were all part of the power plant. And you had to take off just the minimum controls, you know, the fuel pipes in, the oil pipes in, the controls to it. Probably a dozen things you had to disconnect instead of hundreds of things. And the power plant came off, and you put a new service power plant back on, which of course meant that you had to have somebody to build up the new service power plants. And I got in the power plant bay there, and we were building power plants for Dakotas. Well, a lot of them got that way in the end, but it was just a Dakota. The Dakota was the first one, American
was
idea.
DC-3,
yeah.
And so you moved. You moved into the power plant.
Yeah, which was the opposite side of the airfield to what.
So what were exactly were you doing then?
Just stripping. You get a power plant in it. It was almost always because the engine was being changed. So you took the old engine out, took it away, stuck a new engine on the power plant, serviced everything, renewed all the necessary bits that you had to renew on the pipelines, and just put it back ready to put in the aircraft. And
you enjoyed that work more?
Well, yes, it was back to being a fitter again. It really was being a fitter there, because you had to lots of things, bits and pieces you had to make. Nowadays, they shudder if you talked about making bits for aircraft, but we used to make our own pipes and bend them and all sorts of things like that. It's That's a power plant.
Now, so you were doing that. So
yes.
You're working in the power plant bay, and you're doing your civilian qualifications.
Yeah.
At the BAOSC school. Anything else happening in this? You're there a year, aren't you?
Yes, I was there quite a while. Yeah, well, now I did the same job all the time. Yeah, I mean, to start with, of course, I was on the route. I can't remember, probably 3 months on that. But then I went on to the...
Now, what happens next, then?
I went from there. The Egyptians were pushing us to get out of El Marza because we were sharing El Marza with the Egyptian Air Force. And the Egyptians, okay, politically, wanted us to get out. So everybody that was forces in Egypt were more or less moved into the canal zone. So I moved to Krabit within the canal zone, doing exactly the same job. I moved it there.
Still with 113 staging post, then?
It 113 staging post was a separate entity. That was a different unit on El Marza. I moved from 113 staging post to headquarters El Marza, which was the engineering side of it.
So. Oh, so it's 113 staging post, and then you were, and when you went to the power bay, you were the headquarters.
Yeah. Exactly.
Headquarters maintenance unit.
Well, I can't explain that, but was, yes, that's good enough. Headquarters maintenance unit as well. It was just the engineering section, and we served just all the stuff from Dakotas all over Egypt. It was there.
Now, when you move to the next move is to Krabit. Are you still with the headquarters unit?
Well, no, it's again, Krabit was a separate unit. It was RAF Krabit, and at Krabit we had two or three squadrons of Dakotas, and we were the power plant bay. Again, the power plant bay based in the central engineering department. I mean, there are other parts of it that serves in that, but I was specifically on the power plant bay.
And that's part of the maintenance unit?
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
And did things change there, or was it just the same thing?
It was exactly the same job, exactly the same. It was just the same, doing the very same job, using the same equipment. We shipped all the equipment from El Marza over to Krabit, and that was it. The only thing that changed, as far as I'm concerned, that's worth noting, is that at this time we had sharing the camp with a huge prisoner of war camp, German prisoner of war camp, with the people that the Germans had been captured up the desert. And they were still in the prisoner of war camp there, the Germans there.
Now, did you have much contact? What did you think of them?
Well, I can only talk about my experience with them. I had absolutely no contact with them. I had two of them, Hans and Willie, I can remember the names now, working with me, because I think I'm corporal there. I got up to corporal. I think I am.
Yeah, you're promoted while you're there.
Yeah, that's right. And I was running the power plant bay there, and I had these two Germans who were both ex-Luftwaffe ground engineers. I can only, with all honesty, say they were better engineers than the British were. They were better trained. There's no argument about it. They were good engineers, and they quite willingly worked with us on these things. Loosely, and I wouldn't want to say this is the knowledge of the time, they could work with us because we were working on airliners, Dakotas. They weren't war aeroplanes. Actually, of course, a load of rubbish, but they dropped paratroops and things like this. But the war was over, and they were only being held pending being sent back to Germany. And so we worked with these two, but lots of people out of the German prisoner of war camp went on different jobs all over the place. I mean, they were quite glad to, just like me, instead of whiling away at time doing nothing at all. They just came to work with us, and worked with us quite well.
Now, anything about your time? Yeah, then you're there from September 46 to round about February 47, and you go home.
Yeah.
Anything about your time there? Anything happening, or is it just working in the power plant?
Just working in the power plant. Exactly the same, no difference. But the hours became more normalised. No, we.
Can I just ask you what you thought of the Dakota DC-3? It's such a famous aircraft. You were only doing the power plant, but what did you think?
I was only doing the power plant, but throughout I was probably 11 years working on Dakotas throughout my RS. And it was a damn good aircraft for its day.
What's so good about it?
Well, it was so reliable, it never went wrong, if anything like that. Its only problem was it was underpowered, like so many airplanes in those days. I flew hundreds and hundreds of hours in Dakotas. When I went in, I'm just going forward a little bit, but when you did ask me Dakota, when I was going a bit for higher education, where I'd neglected at school, and I realised I was short of a bit of education, I took vocational training courses and this sort of thing, and I used to spend most of my time studying in the Dakota on trips around. It's the most relaxing place.
They were all right to fly in then?
Well, compared to an aircraft nowadays, they were bloody awful. I mean, they were noisy, they were rattling, they shook about everything. But to me, in those days, it was a nice aeroplane. They used to fly around quite happily. I mean, there's still the odd one flying about now, but their death came because it couldn't maintain a one-engine takeoff. Then it rapidly became, after the war, one of the first things that no aircraft could fly if it couldn't, well, I mean, obviously the single engines, but that no airliner of a Dakota stage could fly if it couldn't maintain flight on one engine at takeoff, so that Dakota had to just go as a passenger airliner, could use it as freight airliners, which were going for many, many a year. In fact, I think there's still some of them screwing around the sky now. But yeah, everything was Dakotas then.
So, anything else about Cabrit? In that 5 months you were there? Did it make much of a difference being a corporal?
No. Except I could tell people off more. No, it made very little difference to be the court. It's not until you become a senior NCO it makes any difference. No, you just, if you try, it's human nature. If you try to, you'd lived with all the ranks, I mean, you lived in the same billets and that. If you were lucky, you used to get a room of your own at the end, but there were more corporals than rooms at end, so you lived with them, and it's no good trying to be flipping shirty and uptight and all, like you're seeing these films of the army, the corporal and that, and some of them probably were, but when you live with them, you live with them, and that was it. You just had to be all part and parcel. It was just more pay for, as far as I was going, more pay and more responsibility.
So how did it all come to an end? I mean, you seem to be a long time before you demobbed.
Well, that was the point. We went on strike for demob.
Tell me about that. How was the strike?
Well, that actually happened that before we went to Cabrit, that was at Cairo West, at Al Marza, we went on strike.
No, tell me what happened, exactly what happened, as you remember it.
Well, I can tell you this, from what I was saying in the West Name, read about it later, and we got leaflets. What happened basically was that there was a demob program going on, and there was thousands and thousands of army, air force, everybody overseas, and like all government dues, they weren't getting them back fast enough. They hadn't got the facilities to get them back, so they were coming back slowly, and they started what was called a points system. This point system, if you're a married man with 6 kids, you got home tomorrow, you know. If you're a single bloke like me, you might get home next year and you might get home 2 years' time. There was no rush there. Well, we were all brassed off, man. We didn't want to stay in Egypt, so we all wanted to come back. But nobody in authority told us about these. We had what they called demob notices. And these demob notices had got up to about number 11 when the strike happened. And nobody had told us. The CO or whoever is responsible on the admin side were getting these notices, but instead of pinning them up and letting us know what was going on, we didn't even know there was a point system. We knew that pretty obviously if you're going to be mad, you're allowed to get back before the others, but we didn't know how the point system worked. We didn't know anything about it. We didn't know any reason whatsoever about it at all. So we just got uptight about it. We had bad conditions. We had a lousy flipping SWO who used to chase us around and all sorts of things like that. So there was just a lot of discredit.
So who organised the strike? I mean, because, you know, that's the thing.
Absolutely no doubt whatsoever in my name. It was communist organised. It's
Who did it?
Right, I shall go on to that in detail. they allowed us all sorts of freedoms. I mean, politics is not allowed in the Air Force at all. It still isn't, beside the point. I know you're allowed to vote now. But you were allowed to vote then. Don't put you off. But you weren't allowed to politic in the forces. You didn't have to run for things like that. And they allowed us to start what was called a wall newspaper about news in the world and all the, around the way and that. And we had this in the education block. There was an education block in the Air Force after the war. We had this in the education block. And this was getting more and more and more outspokenly communist. But we didn't know what a bloody communist was, didn't know anything about this. All we knew this it was knocking the government, it was knocking the Air Force. It was great. Yeah, all right, mate, you see. And then this strike evolved. Now,
how did it evolve?
It evolved because somewhere along the line, these people had organised it. Now, I know exactly the bloke that organised it. You know, he was actually a driver of a fuel bowser, and he's the most insignificant little prank you've ever seen. But he organised it with us. And what happened is...
Do you remember his name?
No, I can't. Unfortunately, I can't. I just do not remember. I know it was so insignificant, nobody thought, no, give him a... Tuppence to the day sort of thing.
Now, how did this ringleader operate?
It called the strike. Everybody come into the NAFI on a certain time. We all went in. We were all quite happy. Oh, we wanted to go in there. That was it. Everybody went in there. There's probably half a dozen that were regular Air Force people didn't go in because of that. We goes in and said, that's it. We're not going to work. End
Who
of it.
Said that?
This guy. This is where I know, and from what I read later, it was obviously a totally organised deal because he stood at the back so nobody could recognise him. So that when the SWO came in to start with, oh, you lot get back to work, you know, and booed him down. And we loved this because we hated him.
Now, what was happening? How many were at the meeting? What was going on?
It was just a disorderly meeting of people that said, we're not going to work until we get this, we've got our demands and all the rest of it.
But was there anyone running the meeting?
Yeah, this guy at the back. But this is why I'm saying it's absolutely certain. Because at the same time, I can't tell you now, it's all in the history. I've still got the paper, the demob leaflet that I got from about this. At the same time, all through the Middle East and the Near East, by radio contact, the radio operators in the Air Force sent there. All of us came out at the same time. India everywhere. Now, that was organised.
You didn't know about
that? I didn't know this at the time, no. It was great fun, you see.
Now, what type of strike was called? I mean, what were you going to do? I mean, you know.
Stop work, that was all. It didn't work. That was it. You just stopped going to work.
What did the authorities do?
Well, to start with, they tried to put in normal service discipline, which, of course, as soon as you put in normal service discipline, it doesn't work. What the hell do we do now, you know? Do we bring the guns out and shoot them? No, can't do that. So they then started to disseminate, and we had officers come from headquarters and that, who disseminate this information we got and explained it all to us. The food improved. The food improved magnificently. It was that's some good grub. In fact, they just calmed us down, and that was it. I think we only had about, I can't remember, it's probably 3 days we were on strike. And that called
now,
it
how
down.
How did it called off? You know, who called it off, or did you just drift back to work?
As far as I know, we just drifted back. I don't think it was called off in any particular way. It just happened. And that
do
was
you know
it.
What month this was? Because, you know, you were at Armada, but when?
I can't remember. I think it may have been in about September, but it's quite well recorded in the histories.
We'll look at September.
I think it was
45. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be it. Yeah, but I wouldn't go nap on the actual month, but it was probably around about that time, and then everything settled back to normal again.
46. Hang on there.
Right. Well, again, I. 46, yes, it would be 46.
Just before you leave.
Just before, yeah, just before he came back. And from there on, it's pretty obvious, as I can't say for sure, but it's pretty obvious to my mind, that they then decided to do what's trying to do now about some of the things that are on. They did something about it. And demob started to move. and we all started to go back. That's where we came.
So you
back.
Didn't stay at Armagh long. You then went to Cabrit shortly
yeah,
after.
Yeah, that's
strike.
It. Yeah.
Anything else about the strike? I mean, did you get to know this chap?
Only in passing. No, I didn't get to know him personally. No. But there's absolutely no doubt about it in my mind, and I've thought about it since at the time I didn't know. The Wall newspaper, it's typical of the stuff that you read afterwards about the communists, the way they were the proletariat and all this sort of rubbish they're coming out with. But at those days, we thought it was great. You should regularly go down and read the newspaper. It's fun, you know, take the mick out the CO and all this sort of thing. It was part of what life was made of.